Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering a special rescue made by the Sandy Pines Wildlife Center.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
In a cat carrier, an animal that looks like a cross between a squirrel and a raccoon, but unlike anything native to Canada, looks grumpy. He certainly sounds grumpy, and rightfully so. He's over 3,000 kilometers away from home, and he didn't exactly buy a ticket. Sandy Pines Wildlife Center in Napanee recently welcomed an unexpected guest last month, whose journey is still unfolding. The story began after receiving a call from a manufacturer reporting a strange animal found in a shipping container. Sue Meach, director of Sandy Pines, recounts the unusual call they received on the evening of June 16th.
We got a call from some people in Belleville that worked at an auto parts store. They said that they had a Mexican raccoon in a bin, and it had been there for a day, and they put some water in, but they didn't know what to do with it.
Sandy Pines volunteer Greg Oosting was sent to investigate the next day. What he found was certainly not a raccoon, but needed help nonetheless.
I said, be prepared for what you see. I'm really not sure what this is, but we need to help the animal. Anyway, he got there and he said, well, this isn't a raccoon, but I'm going to catch it anyway. And it's going to die if it stays in here. So he was able to trap it. And then it was brought into us by a volunteer.
Once at the center, staff quickly identified the visitor as a caco mussel, a small nocturnal mammal native to Central America, characterized by its dark-ringed tail.
It's a very small mammal. It's only weighs less than a kilogram. So it's very small, about half the size of a cat, maybe a six-month-old kitten. And it has a long tail with beautiful gray and white stripes, or black and white stripes, actually, all the way up. At first, we were told it was a lemur, but when we did our homework and started looking it up online, we realized that it couldn't be a lemur because lemurs come from Africa. So we did a bit of research and discovered that there was a similar species in South America or Central America, and it was commonly known as a ringtail, but the technical name is a caco mussel. So it arrived, and at least we knew what we were getting, and we were prepared somewhere for him. They like trees to climb, so we had a barn stall set up with trees in it, branches in it that have been donated by very generous people who trim their trees and bring branches in for our animals. And we set up a nice little den in there for him, and in he went. Apparently, the company in Belleville makes headlights for vehicles, and they pack up the headlights in sea cans and sends them to Mexico. Mexico then sends back the empty sea can, and somehow this little guy, I can see how he's so small. If he'd gotten into the corner of a really big sea can in the dark, when you looked in, you wouldn't spot him right away.
While the stowaway was frightened, it was coping well under the unusual circumstances. The question now was how to return it home, or at the very least, to a safe environment.
So then it was the dilemma of what is the legal process for handling a situation like this. I have not. Well, we did have this happen once with a bird. We had an albatross here many years ago that was not indigenous to Canada. So, but that was with Canadian Wildlife Services that do the avian species. So I reached out to the Ministry of Natural Resources, and who I'm a custodian. I have a license under their authority. And they said, well, it wasn't their department, called the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They deal with animals crossing the border, apparently, whether they're exotics or food animals that are coming in. Anyway, they laughed when I called them and said, well, it's funny that you should call us, because we got a call from Belleville and they said to bring the animal to you and call you. So I was going round in circles here.
Meets began reaching out for guidance and suggestions. Eventually, she connected with Lee Parker, zoo director at Little Rays Nature Center, an exotic animal rescue located in Ottawa.
But I have a friend who's a vet in Ottawa, and she had told me that she works with exotics. So I explained to her that we have this caca missile, and we were quite happy to give him temporary accommodation. But obviously he needed something more than we could give him, maybe even try to get him back to Mexico. Anyway, she contacted me back and said, Little Rays has a nature center in Ottawa, and she's the veterinarian in charge there. And she checks all the animals as a volunteer. And she thought that would be the best place for him while we figured out a solution for this little guy. So I contacted Lee at the nature center, and he said that this was an unusual case, and they usually seem to get calls about reptiles and snakes, but he would be very happy to help. So he even said that they would come and pick up the animal, which was a great help because this is such a busy time for us. Anyway, he came and we had him all packed up, his bags packed and everything, and off he went.
While reptiles or amphibians sometimes slip into Canada, this case involving a mammal is a less common occurrence, according to Parker.
So with mammals in Canada, I mean, I've been in Canada for 17 years, going on 18 years, and we often get smaller animals like reptiles and amphibians come through, and they often come through either in fruit or flowers and things like that, which is a little bit, I mean, it's not, you don't get it every month or so on, but I mean, we do hear it, and there's often probably a lot of them that don't even survive because they often put chillers on the flowers or the fruit and stuff, and food goes into cold storage and things like that, and a lot of these animals probably won't survive. But for mammals, in the time that I've been at Little Rays, this is our first one that that I'd heard of coming through like this, but I'm sure it's not the only case of it.
The Caco missile was transferred to Little Rays Nature Center just before the long weekend. Now safely housed at Little Rays, work is being done to determine its origin and what next steps can be taken.
So really the process that we have when something like this comes in, when I got the call from Susan, I mean, Susan does a lot of rescue for native species. And when you have something that's exotic coming in or from another country, you have to be cautious about cross-contamination, especially if you're having animals going back into the wild. So she reached out to me saying, would Little Rays be able to take this animal on so that it had a place to go? And then we could either try and figure out a way to get it back to where it came from, or if not that, and it couldn't leave Canada, then where would we be able to find a forever home for this animal should it need to be there? So the steps that have happened right now is that I've gone through the CFIA, which is Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They deal with balls as well as food and things like into Canada. And I was on a call with them three times yesterday, and they obviously often don't get this either. So they are working through this currently with me to find out what the best option is and what the steps going forward is with this animal. Since then, we have reached out to a facility that is willing to take it should the CFIA deem that fit for the animal. But at this point in time, it is in our quarantine. We are maintaining him. He's eating. He's a wild animal, so he's not used to people. So we're keeping him under as little stress as possible. We're not overactive in the habitat or anything like that. We go in, we do our routine maintenance of cleaning, feeding, and water changing and stuff like that, monitoring, make sure he's okay. And then once we hear back from the CFIA, we can then proceed with steps for any further veterinary care, whether he needs to have rabies vaccinations, a body checkup, make sure everything's where it needs to be, maybe make sure there's no other illnesses, so maybe some blood work and things like that before he actually gets moved on to his forever home. If he ends up finding out where he came from, and that's what the CFIA are trying to do, to see exactly where this container came from in the United States, Mexico area, that's where these guys are found, because some of these animals in certain areas are critically endangered. So obviously, if this is an animal in that situation, we would rather get this animal back to where he came from. And that's what we're working on currently.
While Sandy Pines will be getting back to business as usual, mostly with native species, they remain committed to helping in any way they can with the resolution, whether that means a return to the wild or a safe new home.
Well, they said they had a nice big area for him with some trees in it, so he would be safe in there until they could figure out something. Some department of the government is going to have to be involved. And if he is being sent anywhere, we will have to get permits and jump through a lot of hoops. But we'll do our best for this little guy. But at least I know he's in a safe place. And he's under veterinary care.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about a TLTI council vote on tripling the temporary borrowing limit.
Thank you, Jesse. The Township of Leeds in the Thousand Islands is set to consider a bylaw that would increase its temporary borrowing limit from $1 million to $3 million at its Committee of the Whole meeting on Monday. The recommendation comes as part of an annual housekeeping requirement under the Municipal Act, which permits municipalities to borrow funds temporarily to manage cash flow needs until taxes and other revenues are collected. Staff says the proposed increase better reflects municipal standards and is prudent in light of the township's financial outlook and upcoming capital projects. While Council previously approved a $1 million borrowing limit for 2025 at its December meeting, staff is now recommending passage of a new bylaw that would repeal the earlier measure and raise the limit to $3 million. Based on the amount of the current tax levy and potential cash flow pressures in the future, staff are recommending to increase the temporary borrowing limit to $3 million should the need arise, the report states. According to staff, cash flow pressures can emerge in years with significant capital expenditures, particularly as major spending often occurs before the township collects the second half of annual taxes in September. With capital reserve funds expected to decline in the coming years before recovering, a higher temporary borrowing ceiling offers flexibility to manage those demands. The borrowing limit remains well below the upper threshold set by the Municipal Act. In the first 9 months of the year, municipalities can borrow up to 50% of their annual revenues, dropping to 25% after September 30th. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about a generous donation from KGH Auxiliary to Kingston Health Sciences Centers.
Thank you, Dinah. Last week, Kingston General Hospital Auxiliary presented Kingston Health and Sciences Center with a donation of $314,650, contributing to a number of equipment purchases and education for members of staff. The donation will fund purchases of 4 NICU ventilators and 15 oncology treatments, with remaining funds helping to finance annual education funding for KHSC staff through the Millennium Bursary Fund, as well as subsidizing departmental programs to support elder life and critical care. Chelsea Reynolds, president of KGH Auxiliary, says the amount donated has reached back to pre-COVID levels after a few years of lower fundraising amounts due to restrictions on visitors within hospitals. She says it really cut off almost all ability to fundraise, although staff members tried to continue to support efforts. Reynolds says that in previous years, funds have been directed towards redevelopment projects, but with those on hold while awaiting provincial involvement, KGH Auxiliary decided to direct funds to areas where an immediate impact could be made. The funds from KGH Auxiliary come largely from sales at the on-site locations of the Auxiliary Cafe, the Lottery Booth, the Tuck Shop, and the Gift Shop, as well as programs like the Teddy Bear Campaign, where funds are always earmarked for pediatrics. This past year, the campaign accounted for $28,000, and the KGH Auxiliary Board decided where to direct the remaining funds, choosing to support efforts in pediatric care and oncology treatment. In a release from KHSC, President and CEO David Pecora expressed thanks to KGH Auxiliary and said their efforts make a big difference. Over the course of 120 years, the Auxiliary has contributed over $20 million from fundraising efforts.
And thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about public concerns over a proposed subdivision in Bath.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
A number of Bath residents came forward to speak at this week's public meeting regarding a draft plan of a subdivision in Bath. The subdivision in question is part of a number of phases of construction in the area. The draft plan looks at a space located at the north end of Country Club Drive, north of Main Street, and west of Church Street in Bath. Council heard from residents as they voiced a number of concerns. The first to speak, Grant Lindsay, brought up the lack of parks.
With the shift in the type of housing geared more towards families and families with children, there is a distinct lack of parkland for these children. There's only one existing site in this entire community, and that's the only active parkland space where there's a swing set where you can take your child.
Resident Jeremy Horworth mentioned Caitlin's responsibility to provide park space.
It's my understanding that a developer has to put a certain amount of funds aside to provide parks or something. I've never seen that from Caitlin.
Another resident, Louise Sweet, spoke about the issue of the construction traffic.
The construction traffic that is currently happening up and down Country Club Drive. I know Caitlin is aware of it, and it's something that's a major concern for the number of people on Country Club.
Resident Nancy Trudell also mentioned the speed of construction traffic.
My biggest concern is the speed. With the construction vehicles, the tradesmen, even some homeowners pass my house. Because now that there's children in the area, it's dangerous. It's way too fast.
A newer resident of Bath and former police officer in Kingston, Mr. Cuthbert, described the potential dangers resulting from these issues.
I'm a police officer, a retired police officer for 48 years. I see all the construction coming up Country Club that makes it into 10 and then carries on into 11, 12, and 13. With all due respect, the traffic is disgusting. The improper vehicles that are coming up, the construction vehicles are coming up, construction vehicles coming from other sites all the way up Country Club into this site and then going back. You know what? I think there's three children in phase 10. Okay. I don't know. They walk up and down the street. They walk way to the other end in order to join the playground, or their parents have to drive them down there. And I feel sorry for them. Can't go onto the golf course. They either play in the streets where all this construction traffic is, someone's going to get hurt.
Resident Sid Dick spoke about the golf course's driving range being relocated.
They also, when I bought 7 years ago, showed us a golf course that had a driving range and all the other amenities that go with a golf course. And it's my understanding that the driving range now is to be relocated. And that changes the project that I was presented and the representation that was made to me when I bought my unit. They're representing things to people to buy, and they're not living up to what they're saying. They're changing to maximize their opportunities.
Loyalist Township's planning supervisor, James Griffin, detailed how parkland is being factored into the proposal.
In terms of this application, what is being proposed is cash in lieu of parkland. So the Planning Act requires 5% of the land be dedicated for parkland. If 5% of the land isn't dedicated, then we get a cash in lieu payment. In terms of the existing parkland for Loyalist Estates, so Loyalist Estates is somewhat of a unique subdivision in that it was given draft approval in the 1990s from the province of Ontario without an expiration date. So it never expired. And at that time, they did provide parkland for the two phases that were the original phases, the north and the south, along County Road 7 or Church Street and Abbeydon.
Griffin addressed concerns about construction traffic as well.
Just in terms of construction traffic, we understand and we hear that. In terms of the haul routes, so for the existing haul routes are there for the existing developments. In terms of this development, ultimately phase 12, which is the connector from one end of Country Club to the other end of Country Club, it needs to be completed because we need the water services to be looped to the other end of Country Club in order to service phase 14. So ultimately, that would be completed before phase 14 would continue, or at least the not fully completed, but a pre-servicing agreement would be entered into and the services and the road would be constructed.
A recommendation will be brought forward to council once comments from township departments, agencies, and the public have been fully addressed. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the search for a new CEO for Community Care Northumberland.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. 2026 will see new leadership at Community Care Northumberland as Trish Baird, CEO of the nonprofit for the past 36 years, is retiring. The idea of passing the torch has been on Baird's mind for a while. While she has been instrumental in growing this organization, she says she is excited about its future.
I kind of felt the same way, you know, at 20 years, at 25, at 30. Why am I staying here? But, I mean, I love my job. But the main reason is our organization. It's great to work here, especially with all of the volunteers and the employees. We all have kind of that similar value system, and it's perfect to be able to work in that environment and enjoy working with those people. So there's, you know, you never have a dull day, and I figure I'm here in my own, I live in my own community, I can help out my own community, so it's been great in that sense.
So let's talk about the beginnings. 12 employees, approximately 100 volunteers. Now it's 100 employees and 500 volunteers.
Yeah.
How are you successful in making that grow?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people along the way, and I guess I've just been able to lead them on. Certainly when I first started here, the types of services that were provided were fairly new in helping people in communities. So it was, you know, those isolated seniors, let's get them out. Meals on Wheels was running in the community by volunteers and other organizations. But a lot of volunteers worked to get seniors out of their homes that were isolated, and to have social and check-ins with them. So that was kind of how Community Care started, was in those fledgling organizations across Northumberland County, and the government started to help fund that. So I think through the realization that this helped people stay at home, stay well, prevented disease, prevented, you know, hospitalization, the more and more funding was added to that, and more recognition that supports such as, you know, helping people get to medical appointments through transportation, or helping them with personal distress alarms in their home, that as an aging population, those needs just grew and grew. So we certainly grew as our funding and supports were available, but it was never 100% funding. It always started in the day. It was, I think, 70% funding from the government, and we always had to fundraise, and clients had to pay for some of those services that had fees to them. So without that support and that extra money and fundraising, we wouldn't have been able to grow that way. But we also, you know, they also brought in programs that were maybe on their own. So, for example, like in Port Hope, the Red Cross ran the Meals on Wheels in Port Hope, and we were able to bring that into Community Care and to provide, you know, be that multi-service organization that's able to cover the full county. And as awareness grew and our aging population grew, that's how, you know, we became what we are today. Now, certainly a big part of that is our hospice services. And in 2010, there was what's called an integration where hospice services, or community hospice services, joined Community Care Northumberland. So that was kind of new into our world, and certainly the recognition of hospice services is now, you know, there's lots more money being put into hospice residences, and we built Ed's House, but we also have received not a lot, but funding for grief and bereavement support. So, you know, it's kind of been able to grow in a recognition of the importance of those community supports.
So let's talk about the decision to retire. How did you come to that decision, and how do you feel about it?
Well, I mean, it's been rolling around in my brain for a while, and certainly, you know, it's kind of, when's the right time to retire? And I think when you start thinking those things, that's probably the time to retire. I think I've kind of done what I can do at Community Care. I'm looking forward to whoever takes on this role to help move it forward into whatever that will be in the future. I have a grandson, you know, a young grandson, and another one on the way, so looking forward to spending time with them. And, you know, the board, I certainly do not want my transition to be smooth. So I've given, the board has known about this, and I want to make sure that I can dump my knowledge from my head into somebody else. And so there's lots of time to do that transition.
What do you think you're going to miss most about this job and maybe helping the community?
I mean, I probably seeing the people that I either work or see as clients or volunteers. I mean, everyone's very lovely and fun to work with. So I will miss, you know, seeing those people. I'm not sure. Maybe ask me, you know, in next July, what do I miss most of Community Care. But I wouldn't be here unless I enjoyed what I did. But I think I'm at the time when I know it's time for somebody else to do it. So I will still live here in our community. I live in Campbellford, so you know, I get to still see lots of people every day that I not only work with but volunteer with in the community. So that won't stop.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, July 10th, daytime high of 24 degrees, a 90% chance of precipitation. It's going to be warm and humid here in the city of Kingston. Friday, July 11th, daytime high of 25, feeling closer to 31 thanks to the high humidity. Saturday, July 12th, a high of 25. It's going to be a beautiful sunny day, perfect start to your weekend. Sunday, July 13th, daytime high of 25, cloudy all day with some light cloud coverage into the afternoon. And then starting off next week, Monday, July 14th, 27 degrees, high UV index, lots of sun in the forecast.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.